And this is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. C. Wright Mills liked to think big, and many on the left in this country and abroad liked Mills's big ideas, as expressed in books about power, democracy, bureaucracy, and freedom. Would the American left have developed the way it did without C. Wright Mills? Asks my author guest Daniel Geary. That would be hard to imagine, given how influential Mills was with thinkers, activists, and concerned citizens, not just in the U.S., but abroad. Mills, a sociologist and public intellectual who spent much of his career at Columbia University, actively engaged with pacifists, with new leftists in Europe, with Cuban revolutionaries, and with many others, imparting his insights in influential books like The Power Elite, The Sociological Imagination, and White Collar. Daniel Geary has written a new book reassessing Mills. It's entitled Radical Ambition, C. Wright Mills, The Left, and American Social Thought. Dan Geary is a lecturer in U.S. history at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland, and I'm delighted that he joins me now in our Berkeley studios. Hi, Dan.
Hi. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. This book grew out of an undergraduate dissertation you wrote on C. Wright Mills. What drew you to Mills as an undergrad?
Well, I guess this would have been, you know, in the 1990s, and this was a time, of course, with the collapse of communism that or left-wing ideas seemed to many people to have been completely discredited. And to look to the past to a thinker like Mills, who similarly lived during a period of decline in left-wing ideas, I think was something that was very interesting and engaging to me. And also just, I mean, the way that he writes, he's a very engaging and forceful writer, and I think interested me and lots of other undergraduates to whom I've taught Mills.
And did you take a course that included some readings on Mills early on?
Well, I think I encountered him in the context of the 1960s and his influence on the New Left. That must have been where I first came across him.
And we're going to talk about that in some detail today. Mills was born in 1916 in Waco, Texas, to a father who worked for an insurance company and a woman who was a devout Catholic. What else should we know about C. Wright Mills's early life and his education?
Well, the family traveled around in Texas because of his father's job. Mills, at an early age in high school, rejected Catholicism, insisted on going to a public high school, not a Catholic school. First was sent by his father, who wanted to sort of make a man of Mills, to Texas A&M, which at the time was a military school. And Mills couldn't stand it there. There were a lot of hazing rituals for freshmen, and Mills thought that these were just stupid and mean. So he wound up more happily at the University of Texas at Austin, where he completed his BA and then an MA. And the University of Texas at Austin was a sort of the intellectual and cultural capital of Texas, and a much more cosmopolitan place where Mills sort of began to engage ideas and first think of himself as an intellectual.
And was C. Wright Mills what we might call an egghead intellectual?
Not at all. I mean, he was part of this is that Texas image about him, that, you know, he wasn't a sort of a Eastern elite. He was also a very big man. He was over 6 feet, you know, over 200 pounds. You might think he was, you know, had played football, though he hadn't. And he was very much active with his hands as well as with his brain. He built, helped to build and design two of his own houses later on, and also was probably most famous for riding a motorcycle, which he knew how to fix as well.
And many have portrayed Mills as sort of this motorcycle riding maverick, kind of a political renegade. Do you agree with that characterization?
There is this legend that has grown up about Mills that he was this maverick on a motorcycle. And of course, he did drive a motorcycle. But if you look beyond the legend, I mean, the thing about the motorcycle is Mills started to drive it because there was a parking shortage near Columbia University. So there are parts of that legend that are true. And that legend had a certain appeal. It's one that Mills himself promoted, one that a lot of New Left students in the 1960s took up, as well as Mills's ideas. This image of him was attractive. But I think it's time to look beyond the image and for a sort of fuller picture of what his ideas really were. It's sort of a caricature of Mills that doesn't tell us the full story of his life and its historical meaning.
Well, part of your argument in this book, it's called Radical Ambition. We're joined by Daniel Geary, the author. a part of your mission in this book is to put Mills in context, to show how he was linked to certain currents, both within sociology. He was a sociologist, he was an academic sociologist, but also broader left intellectual ideas. Can you give us we'll talk more about this in detail, but a general sense of the extent to which you see him as part of a milieu as opposed to just sort of this renegade dissident?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when Mills sort of first becomes a radical in the early 1940s, he's connected to circles in the labor movement. He's also connected to many other prominent intellectuals at the time. Mills was in New York then, and Dwight MacDonald's very small but influential magazine, Politics, published in the 1940s. Mills had suggested the title for that. Into the 1950s, Mills was closely connected with the magazine Dissent, founded by Irving Howe and Louis Koser, which is still around. And then, as we'll talk about later in the 60s, he has close connections to other leftist and left-wing movements at the time. So Mills sometimes portrayed himself as a loner, and he often is portrayed that way today. But the reality is he was part of these much larger networks.
Did C. Wright Mills, did he align himself with any particular leftist tendency?
He did not, and that's one of the interesting things about him. I mean, he came of age in the 1940s, so he, in a way, he missed the communist debates of the 1930s. Even though Mills was always an anti-communist, he was never a vehement anti-communist to the extent that many other leftists were. On the other hand, even though he had contacts within Trotskyist circles, you know, he never joined any particular political party. And this, I think, non-sectarian character of Mills's radicalism was one of its appeals, especially to people in the 1960s who were tired of the old debates about communism and you know, wanted to sort of get on with the cause of social justice.
Well, tell me more about Mills's anti-communism. Was he anti-communist because of the way communism had turned out? The sort of actually existing communism that he saw being practiced, for example, in the Soviet Union? And then also, how did he feel about socialist movements that weren't communist?
Well, Mills was a big supporter of socialist movements that were not communist. At times, he called himself a socialist. He was never part of a socialist party. But I think he broadly saw himself as a non-communist socialist. In his later years, he would describe himself as a plain Marxist, someone who was committed to Marxist ideas, but not to specific communist movements, at least those affiliated with the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc. Mills was always a critic of them and saw it as a Stalinist bureaucracy that had perverted the original ideas of socialism.
Well, how about then pre-Stalin USSR? How did he feel about that?
Well, I think Mills is a little unclear there. I mean, he had more fondness for Lenin, than he did certainly for Stalin. But I don't think he was ever I don't think Mills was ever committed to that kind of vanguardist politics that the Bolsheviks were associated with. Mills's politics grew more, I think, out of American traditions of radical democracy, going back to the populists, even, certain elements of the progressives, people like John Dewey. So Mills was very interested in fostering democratic discussion and working with, in that sense, more within radical American traditions.
You write that C. Wright Mills wrote a number of books that broke with the post-World War II liberal consensus. What were the main features or elements of that consensus?
Well, I think post-war liberals, the key phrase here is the end of ideology. This is a phrase that was popularized by Daniel Bell, though used earlier. And a lot of American liberals believed that essentially the central problems of industrialized capitalism had been solved, that the sort of the mixed welfare state, the post-New Deal order in the U.S. had made both laissez-faire capitalism, no longer relevant, but also more radical socialist alternatives no longer relevant. So it was a liberal view that supported the successes of the New Deal order, but also saw, believed that there was nowhere further to go. And for that reason, that radical ideology, at least in the Western world, was no longer necessary.
So in some sense, were they arguing that no longer was conflict necessary, but no longer did conflict exist within the U.S.?
I think that's right. They didn't see any serious conflict that could not be resolved within the American political system. And going along with liberal ideas, another popular one at the time was the idea of pluralism, which was the idea that different interest groups could effectively resolve conflict through the American constitutional and democratic system as it had grown up.
And you write that while Mills confronted this liberal consensus, this post-war consensus, in some ways, some of his ideas resemble those of the liberal thinkers whom he targeted. Give us an example or two of this.
Well, I think Mills took the liberal idea of the individuality and, in a sense, accepted its premises, that is, that there was a kind of consensus to American life, that it was no longer a dynamic society with the kinds of far-reaching social changes that it had seen in the 1930s and World War II, but it settled into, a kind of a consensual post-war order. But instead of seeing that as mostly a positive thing, as the liberals did, Mills critiqued that. He saw it as a false consensus. But because he agreed with liberals, there was a certain static and non-dialectical quality to his thought that often made him very despairing, because he couldn't see any particular developments within American society that might lead to future social change.
You write that part of this consensus and part of what Mills agreed about this consensus was that, quote, central problems of modern society pertain to individual psychology rather than to material economic deprivation. What does that mean?
Well, what I mean by that is liberals, it's not that liberals at this time had no complaints about American society, but their complaints tended to be less political and more cultural or psychological. And Mills, in many ways, agreed with that. He felt that because of the New Deal, material problems were no longer the main issue, but that it was rather psychological problems. And he addressed this most fully in his 1951 book, White Collar, which was about what he called the new middle classes, that is to say, people who worked in offices or buildings instead of the old middle class of farmers and salaried professionals. And Mills saw that these people, materially were not deprived, but psychologically, their lives were not as rich as they could be, because they were working for large and personal organizations, doing work that did not engage their full personality, that was boring, and then also, meant they were sort of subjected to the hierarchies of these corporations, that they didn't control their work.
His name is Daniel Geary. He is a lecturer in U.S. history at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. His work on C. Wright Mills began with an undergraduate thesis completed in 1997 at the University of Virginia. And he is author of Radical Ambition, C. Wright Mills, The Left and American Social Thought, published by University of California Press. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Well, let's stay with this book, White Collar, The American Middle Class, written by Mills, published in 1951. What about modern organization and modern corporate hierarchy, say, or institutional hierarchy? What did he say was the characteristic, the key elements of those institutions, such that workers felt less autonomy and felt more alienated, and in his words, were becoming, quote, cheerful robots?
Well, I think for Mills, the problem is the problem of modern bureaucracy, these hierarchically organized institutions in which most people worked, and that the work that they did was no longer something that they personally controlled. And one example he gave was of salesmen who previously, had maybe had a certain amount of autonomy to sell their wares, decide what to sell, how to sell it. Well, in the modern world of advertising, that function had been taken away from them, and they just became sort of simple representatives of big companies. And perhaps Mills saw that in his own father. It's something that growing up that he saw as his father's lack of autonomy. The problem with Mills' representation of white-collar workers, I think, is that He took what was a very real problem about the de-skilling of work that many workers experienced in these new white-collar organizations they worked for, and he used that to create a kind of personality to assume that, you know, because they didn't have control over their work, they must be simply, you know, tearful robots, that their autonomy was actually taken away from them. And I think it's not a very complex and nuanced view, a portrait that emerges of what he calls the new little men in white collar.
What did he say about what this new white collar workforce was doing with their leisure activity? Did he feel like in some ways they were compensating for their lack of meaningful work in their leisure time?
He felt they were compensating, but not in ways that that again expressed their full human personality, but rather that that dulled their senses. You know, that allowed them to accept the economic and political order. And Mills, like many other mid-century intellectuals, was a great critic of mass culture. We could think here of the Frankfurt School's critique of the culture industries. And the idea there was that mass culture served to distract and entertain workers from the very real problems that they faced in the workplace and in the political order more generally.
Well, this doesn't bode well, and I think you were referring to this earlier, this doesn't bode well for political potential, right? The possibility that these people could become engaged or could want to become engaged politically in any sort of participatory way.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Mills described the era that he was living in as the fourth epoch. What were the key features in his mind of this fourth epoch?
Well, this follows again from his discussion of white collar, the idea that that people had been bound up with impersonal organizations that they could neither control nor understand, and that while the world became increasingly rationalized, you know, that is to say, increasingly organized, the ability of individuals to use their reason to make the decisions or contribute to the decisions that affected their lives was increasingly slipping away.
And could you talk more about his belief in reason and what he saw reason as properly developed might do?
Well, Mills was a big believer in reason. I mean, in that sense, he's a sort of classic Enlightenment figure. And picking up on John Dewey and earlier thinkers, Mills believed that the ability to reason together as a society was the mark of what made a democracy, that at the heart of a democracy is a discussion that various people have about the ends to which they want their society to serve and how to go about serving those purposes. And Mills believed that that discussion was no longer taking place within the United States, and therefore he feared that, in a very real sense, the U.S. was no longer a democracy.
And I think, to a large degree, he was focused on who would act, which population, which group within society would act as an agent for social change. And you indicate in this book, Radical Ambition, that he made a certain transition, that he had a certain idea of who might act as these agents, and then later in his career, closer to his death, his untimely death, his very early death in 1962, right? The idea of who those agents were changed. In the 1930s and 40s, who did he believe in as a key to social transformation?
Well, in the earlier period, you're exactly right. Mills believed in the labor movement. And this is, of course, labor was the great cause of the era. And Mills became specifically involved with the labor movement in the post-World War II period. I mean, we tend to think of the 30s and the, you know, the Flint sit-down strikes. But the post-World War II period saw a tremendous upsurge in labor activity. I mean, there were general strikes, including one in Oakland, California. It had the biggest strike wave of in American history. And Mills was engaged with that in New York City, and really believed that organized labor could be a means to bring about an American, you know, to reinvigorate American democracy, working through its members who had an input into the labor unions, and that workers through the unions could both have increased political control, but also could collectively have more control over the processes of what was going on at the workplace.
And before we continue with this transition, and before I ask you what happened in the late 50s in his thinking, we should talk about maybe C. Wright Mills's book, The New Men of Power. This came out in 1948. What was he arguing then about labor and its role and its political potential?
Well, as I say, Mills was looking toward labor as a possible force for democracy. By 1948, he was already worried that it would not be. And the new amount of power was about labor leaders. And Mills was disappointed in labor leaders, didn't believe they had the kind of foresight the willpower, and in some sense had become entrenched within labor bureaucracies, and that labor leaders were going to accept a role as sort of what he called, lieutenants in the American power system, that they'd be sort of junior leaders, but the real decisions would still be made by the top corporate and political leaders, and those decisions would not be challenged by the labor unions. And, you know, to an extent, Mills was right in that labor unions were by that point not becoming a force to challenge the sort of Cold War political order that was growing up.
So then by the late 40s, did C. Wright Mills have a new idea of who might lead a social change movement?
He didn't. And this was part of what has made his radicalism so pessimistic. He held out the ideals of a different society, but he didn't see any way in which they could be realized. And as a result, much of his social thought was very pessimistic.
Well, let's talk about the transition then. And I think one key transition in his life and in his ideas occurred in the year 1956 when Mills, C. Wright Mills, traveled to Europe for the first time. What did he do while there, and what impact did it have on him and his thinking?
Well, the trip was a real eye-opener for Mills. Interestingly enough, he went as a Fulbright Fellow, and this was a program designed to foster the kind of cultural exchange that would increase sort of American soft power, American prestige abroad. And in this case, they sent, an American radical abroad who finds other radicals within Europe. He was in Denmark, but he found sort of new hopes for radicalism across Europe, especially in England, where the New Left was already forming as a sort of major intellectual force, but also in Eastern Europe, where he believed that events in Poland, especially the Hungarian Revolution, had just happened, but he believed that there was a possibility for Eastern Europe to transform itself into a more humane kind of socialism.
Well, what did he pick up from Britain, for example, and from Poland that suggested to him where new kinds of energy for a, quote, new left, and that term was already beginning to emerge, I believe, in the late 50s, where he thought those key energies might arise from?
Well, Mills, eventually he comes to write a book, which is never published, called The Cultural Apparatus. And this is where he finds new sources for radical opposition. In the 1940s, he was sort of thinking, well, intellectuals need to ally themselves with some larger force for social change. By the late 1950s, he thinks, well, maybe intellectuals, at least defined as a very large substratum of people who are involved in formulating, receiving ideas, maybe they can help to make social change themselves. And he saw this both in England, where there were new left groups that had arisen among students, and also an older group of intellectuals that had been part of the Communist Party but had left after the Hungarian Revolution, but also in Poland, where prominent intellectuals were seen, to Mills at least, to be driving progressive social change there. And by the cultural apparatus, Mills eventually came to think of not just intellectuals like himself, but scientists, cultural workers, people who worked in cultural industries themselves. And he hoped that these workers could, in the cultural industries, sort of take what were corporately organized organizations designed for private profit and use them to different ends.
And you said earlier you were talking earlier about Mills's notion that many of the labor leaders by the late 1940s were sort of co-opted by the system and were working within the system. What was his sense at this time in the late 50s about the extent to which the cultural, to which cultural producers, what he called the cultural apparatus, might have similarly been co-opted?
Well, I think Mills saw them as in a sense, having already been co-opted, but as a potential force for resistance, which is to say, because the production of culture was organized around profit, culture workers faced a particular problems in which they weren't able to express their real views, but had to, do what their bosses told them. But Mills thought that this could be turned around. And he saw elements of that emerging within Britain and within Eastern Europe. So he was became a lot more optimistic about this group than he had been before.
Daniel Geary joins us in our Berkeley studios. This is Against the Grain, and on againstthegrain.org, we have a link to Dan's new book, Radical Ambition, C. Wright Mills, The Left and American Social Thought. Dan teaches U.S. history at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. We'll take a short music break, talk more with Daniel Geary about C. Wright Mills, and you'll also hear some rare archived audio of C. Wright Mills, the man himself. Please stay tuned. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. Noel Hanrahan is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. Joining us today in studio is Daniel Geary. He is teaching U.S. history at Trinity College in Dublin, and he's author of the book Radical Ambition, C. Wright Mills, The Left and American Social Thought. Mills's Letter to the New Left was published in 1960, first in the British journal New Left Review, which was part of the British New Left. What was the gist of this letter to the New Left?
Well, I think the gist of the letter to the New Left was that there was an emerging worldwide left-wing movement, something that Mills had hoped for since the 1940s, and which he now saw arising. He pointed to many things that were going on all across the globe that seemed to contribute to this. And Mills, following on from his ideas of a cultural apparatus, Mills said that the primary agent in these new transformations would not be labor, but it would be what he called a young intelligentsia. And that is to say, you know, the same kinds of groups that had been part of the cultural apparatus. So people arising from the middle class, especially those having to do with industries involving culture, production of culture or knowledge. So it's remarkable here in the late 50s already Mills had this idea, and in 1960, you know, because there is quite a striking difference between the 1930s and 40s with the upsurge of the labor movement and the 1960s where the student movement, sort of a middle class movement, played such a prominent role.
And so they love this, right? They love the idea that they, the intelligentsia, might, according to C. Wright Mills, be sort of the moving force.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, and this is something that a pamphlet which is early on reproduced by the Students for Democratic Society, the SDS, the primary campus-based New Left organization. So, you know, it seemed to speak to these students and to tell them, this is partly what Mills's message was, don't look around, you know, for other agents for social change, you know, be one yourself.
Well, to what extent did his emphasis on the young intelligentsia create a rift between Mills and British New Leftists who might have still believed in the working class as the agent?
They certainly had a difference there. And British intellectuals, including Stuart Hall and E.P. Thompson, wrote to Mills and had an exchange about that and said, you know, we like what you're saying about this global new left, but you're making a mistake by ignoring the labor movement. The working class is still needs to be the central agent for social change. We can't just leave it up to middle class intellectuals.
And yet the British were fascinated by Mills. Why is that? Why were they so excited by who he was and what he represented?
Well, I think it's that looking over across the seas in the 1940s and 50s, British intellectuals saw an America which they believed to be a very conservative force. And when Mills came over there, he delivered a series of public lectures on the radio, also that were well attended in person at the London School of Economics and much noticed in the press. It seemed like here was, as one newspaper called him, the authentic voice of American radicalism. And there might be something else within American society than than just a sort of complacent, conservative Cold War politics. And probably the fact that, that Mills himself, as I say, was a Texan, you know, was in that sense, you know, thought of as particularly American, played into that also.
And he was American, and yet, as you document in this book, Radical Ambition, he was an internationalist, and we've begun to, already to talk about that turn toward the international with his trip to Europe in 1956 for the first time. He also became involved in an internationalist movement in the U.S., the peace movement in the late 1950s. What attraction, and I guess I've already begun to say this, but what attraction did this hold for Mills, and how did he want to contribute to the peace movement?
Well, I think one of the attractions was that the peace movement was truly internationalist. It was closely connected to what was going on abroad. The other thing is that the peace movement was raising the issues that Mills thought were most important. And that is issues having to do with the Cold War and especially the dangers of nuclear war. In the late 50s, you get increasingly an anti-nuclear movement, which its voices are growing louder. And this movement was based in universities and churches, so exactly the kind of places that you would look for if you were looking for a movement of the cultural apparatus.
And he wrote a book called The Causes of World War III. It came out in 1958, was quite popular. What was this book about?
Well, this book was about what Mills, you know, feared if events were to continue to take their course, that a catastrophic nuclear war might result from the Cold War, and to think about, well, ways to avoid that possibility. And he was speaking quite directly to, you know, to the peace movement with that book.
What were some of his ideas for how it could be avoided, World War III?
Well, I think the key for Mills was to build a mass social movement around those issues. And the interesting thing about that book is that it got Mills talking to new audiences, especially in churches. And churches, as I say, was a primary place where the peace movement organized. And Mills was a committed secularist who, as I said earlier, rejected the Catholic Church at a young age and never had a religion. But he finds an audience among Christian pacifists. And he even writes an article for The Nation, which is included in the book, called in which he says, I'm a pagan, but I'm going to speak to the clergy and say to them, look, if you really believe in your Christian values, you have to be a member of the pacifist movement. And many clergymen include Mills's remarks in their own sermons and say, you know, he's right. You know, we do need to take this peace issue very seriously if we're going to be true Christians.
Well, let's hear from C. Wright Mills. He was born in 1916. He died in 1962 at the age of 45. Here is C. Wright Mills speaking at the Cooper Union Forum on December 1st, 1958.
Let us remember that the idea of the overdeveloped society as a society that is at bottom composed of publics and that is democratically run by responsible politicians is at best the proclamation of an ideal, and more usually, a falsifying justification of power. Publics increasingly become part of a mass society in which public discussion, even of the higher circles, is intellectually undermined by the assumed need for expertise and morally corrupted by public relations as the political way of life. The public imagined by democratic theorists does not widely prevail. It is not a significant forum for any politics of real issue. The chances to express and to act upon opinions, no matter how they are formed, are increasingly controlled by powers not truly accountable to any publics. Few, if any, free associations link individuals, publics, and communities on the one hand with the state, the corporation, the military order on the other. Such voluntary associations are no longer a dominant feature of the political structure of the overdeveloped society. Nor is the old middle class of farmers and small businessmen, which once upon a time was an independent basis of democratic strength. That class has been transformed into a set of white-collar employees who, as they are born, make their declarations of dependence. The classic conditions of democracy, in brief, do not exactly flourish in this society. And they cannot, I think, so long as the privately incorporated economy is as dominant and as irresponsible as it is, or so long as the personnel and the ethos of the military ascendancy is as dominant and as irresponsible as it is, or so long as what passes for politics is so largely a semi-organized stalemate of provincial interests occurring in a political vacuum.
That's C. Wright Mills speaking in 1958 in New York City at the Cooper Union Forum. We're talking about C. Wright Mills in the context of a new book published by University of California Press and written by my guest, Daniel Geary. It's entitled Radical Ambition, C. Wright Mills, The Left and American Social Thought. We have a link to it on againstthegrain.org. My name is C.S. Song. Dan teaches U.S. history at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. We're happy to have him in town.